This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will be another question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to wear osteolysis basic science, as well as catastrophic wear and polyethylene sterilization, which are two topics that we covered last week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with wear osteolysis basic science. And the first question reads, osteolysis occurs because there is a histiocytic response by macrophages to wear debris. What size particles are implicated in osteolysis? And the choices are 1, less than 1 micron, also known as a submicron particle, 2, approximately 10 microns, 3, approximately 100 microns, 4, approximately 1,000 microns, and 5, approximately 5,000 microns. So osteolysis is the histiocytic response by macrophages to wear debris particles, which are often less than 1 micron in size, making number 1 the correct answer to this question. So to quickly review, osteolysis is a particle-induced biological process occurring at the bone metal or bone cement interface around total joints, resulting in rapidly expanding focal lesions that may or may not cause loosening. Its slower counterpart, aseptic loosening, involves the identical biological process. Wear particles generated within the joint space are phagocytosed and stored within cells in the joint capsule. Submicron particles are retained within macrophages and are implicated in osteolysis. Campbell et al. Described an isolation method to recover ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene particles from tissues around failed total hip replacements. This process yielded particles that had rounded or elongated shapes. Additionally, the majority of particles isolated were reported to be submicron in size. McKellop reviews 4 topics in wear, including modes, mechanisms, damage, and debris. 4 modes that create debris are described. Wear mode 1 occurs when the 2 bearing surfaces are articulating against each other in the manner intended by the implant designer. Mode 2 occurs when a bearing surface articulates against a non-bearing surface. Mode 3 occurs when third body abrasive particles have become entrapped between the 2 bearing surfaces. And mode 4 occurs when 2 non-bearing surfaces are wearing against each other. Moving on to the next question. Which type of inflammatory cell is thought to be involved in the activation of the biological response to metal-on-metal particulate debris? And the choices are 1, a neutrophil, 2, giant cell, 3, macrophage, 4, eosinophil, and 5, lymphocyte. In metal-on-metal articulations, it is thought that particulate wear debris stimulates lymphocytic invasion due to nanometer-sized wear particles combining with native proteins to form haptens. These haptens then stimulate an immune response similar to a delayed type 4 hypersensitivity reaction via stimulation and activation of T cells or lymphocytes. So the correct answer to this question is 5. A lymphocyte is thought to be involved in the activation of the biological response to metal-on-metal particulate debris. To quickly review, metal-on-metal prostheses generate less volumetric wear than metal-on-polyethylene prostheses and produce smaller, nanometer-sized wear particles. 2 types of adverse reactions have been noted in failed metal-on-metal articulations, and these include 1, perivascular infiltrate on lymphocytes indicative of a delayed type hypersensitivity response to metal wear products, and 2, an aseptic lymphocyte-dominated vasculitis-associated lesion, or an ALVAL lesion. The histopathology of pseudotumors or adverse local tissue reactions has been shown to be consistent with ALVAL lesions. Heisel et al. Reviews the alternative bearing choices for total hip arthroplasty. Ceramic and metal-on-metal bearings have demonstrated reduced wear rates compared to metal-on-polyethylene articulations. However, long-term clinical results have yet to determine any clinical improvement. Davies et al. Evaluated periprosthetic tissue samples from 25 metal-on-metal total hip replacements and compared them to samples from metal-on-polyethylene total hips and osteoarthritic hips. A unique lymphocytic infiltrate was demonstrated in the metal-on-metal hips. The body's immune response to metallic debris is different than its response to osteoarthritis and polyethylene debris. Plummer et al. Demonstrates that ALVAL lesion severity doesn't necessarily correlate with metal ion levels, what we would assume would be higher wear. There does seem to be a predominance of monocytes in the synovial fluid, however, in those with ALVAL lesions. Again, maybe the downstream effectors of the lymphocytic activation if the type 4 reaction is true. To quickly go over the incorrect answers for this question, answer 1, neutrophils are typically stimulated as part of the response to infection, not particulate wear debris. Answers 2 and 3, macrophage, fibroblasts, and giant cells are released in response to the particulate wear debris created from metal on polyethylene articulations, not metal on metal articulations. They may be subsequently recruited by lymphocytes in delayed hypersensitivity reactions, but they are not believed to be the initial activators of the response like lymphocytes are. Answer 4, eosinophilic granuloma formation results from the clonal proliferation of Langerhans type histiocytes and is not related to wear debris. Moving on to the next question, particulate wear debris is central to the mechanisms responsible for aseptic loosening. The severity of the biologic response to particulate polyethylene wear debris is directly proportional to particle, and the choices are 1, size, 2, number, 3, composition, and 4, molecular weight. So the biologic response to polyethylene is highly dependent on the type and quantity of particles. The response is clearly dose-dependent. Multiple cytokines are involved in the biologic response to wear particles, and tumor necrosis factor alpha seems to be among the most important. Its secretion increases during the biologic response to particulate wear debris. Research has shown that particles sized between 0.2 micrometers and 7 to 8 micrometers are the most stimulatory, but a direct proportional correlation does not exist with sizes outside of this range. A lack of correlation also applies to molecular weight and composition of polyethylene debris. Moving on to the next question, which of the following molecules is associated with macrophage-induced osteolysis surrounding orthopedic implants? And the choices are 1, BMP7, 2, IL-10, 3, SOX9, 4, osteoprotegerin, and 5, IL-1. So, of these options provided, IL-1 is most associated with macrophage-induced osteolysis surrounding orthopedic implants. Macrophages initiate the inflammatory cascade associated with aseptic loosening of orthopedic implants by secreting platelet-derived growth factor, prostaglandin E2, TNF-alpha, IL-1, and IL-6. Archibek et al. State the primary cells involved in the process of periprosthetic loosening include the macrophage, osteoblast, fibroblast, and osteoclast. They report the chemical mediators that are responsible for the cellular interactions and effects on bone primarily include PGE2, TNF-alpha, IL-1, and IL-6. Dries et al. Discuss the molecular pathway of aseptic loosening of orthopedic implants. They describe the following steps. 1. Wear debris particles released at the cement-bone interface attract macrophages, which in turn are stimulated to produce pro-inflammatory mediators and proteolytic enzymes. 2. RankL, TNF-alpha, IL-1, IL-6, IL-17, and MCSF mediate the differentiation of myeloid precursor cells into multinucleated osteoclasts, which release cathepsin K, an acid, and cause resorption lacunae. 3. Mesenchymal cells, or prosthesis-loosening fibroblasts, present at the bone surface contribute actively to bone resorption. Moving on to the next question, which of the following is the primary mechanism of polyethylene wear in the hip? And the choices are 1. Fatigue cracking and delamination, 2. Oscillatory fretting, 3. Crevice corrosion, 4. Oxidative degradation, and 5. Adhesion and abrasion. So although previous theories on acetabular wear implicated fatigue cracking and delamination as primary wear mechanisms, these have actually manifested as major modes of polyethylene wear in knees. The primary mechanism of wear in polyethylene acetabular components appear to be adhesion and abrasion. In an analysis of 128 components retrieved at autopsy or revision surgery, wear appeared to occur mostly at the surface of the components and was the result of large strain plastic deformation and orientation of the surface layers into fibrils that subsequently ruptured during multidirectional motion. It was also shown conclusively that 32 mm heads displayed significantly more wear, that is volumetric wear, than either 22 mm or 26-28 mm heads, where a 1 mm increase in size increased volumetric wear by 10%. The wear at the articulating surface was characterized by highly worn polished areas superiorly and less worn areas inferiorly, separated by a ridge. Abrasion was very common, occurring after adhesion and plastic deformation of polyethylene fibrils and abrasion secondary to third body wear. Wear rates decreased with longer survival of components, indicating a bedding in phenomenon, arguing against oxidative and fatigue wear. Crevice corrosion occurs in fatigue cracks with low oxygen tension, such as under screw heads, for example. Oscillatory fretting consists of cyclical abrading of the outer surface from small movements. fatigue, and delamination is predominant in total knee arthroplasty, where stresses are maximum just below the surface of the polyethylene component, causing fatigue over time with subsequent delamination. In contrast, hip wear occurs primarily at the surface of the polyethylene component. Moving on to the next question. A design surgeon has created a new polyethylene acetabular liner for total hip arthroplasty. Early clinical outcomes are comparable to conventional total hip arthroplasty. At four-year follow-up, radioisometric analysis reveals 0.05 millimeter of annual wear in the surgeon's trial patients. Which of the following statements can be made from this data? And the choices are 1. Osteolysis and subsequent component loosening will be minimal if the wear rate continues. 2. Osteolysis and subsequent component loosening will be greater than conventional hip arthroplasty if the wear rate continues. 3. Component positioning should have no effect on wear rates of these bearings. 4. All total hip arthroplasty should use this new polyethylene. And 5. Patient satisfaction will be greater at 10 years of follow-up. So polyethylene wear rates have shown association with osteolysis and subsequent component loosening. Wear rates above 0.1 millimeters per year are at significant risk of osteolysis. Dumbleton et al. Performed a meta-analysis of the literature concerning wear rates and osteolysis. They concluded that osteolysis was rarely observed when the wear rate was less than 0.1 millimeters per year. Sakalkali et al. Reported on 10-year follow-up of 60 total hips performed with cementless tapered circumferentially coated femoral stems. They reported no osteolysis of the femoral component, even though there was a high incidence of acetabular osteolysis. Sochart et al. Reviewed 235 total hip arthroplasties performed by Charnley with 20-year follow-up. Osteolysis and revision was significantly associated with polyethylene wear rates. Average wear rates for hips that did not go on to revision was 0.09 millimeters per year compared to 0.19 millimeters per year for hips that were subsequently revised for loosening. But the correct answer to this question is 1. Osteolysis and subsequent component loosening will be minimal if the wear rate continues in this scenario. Moving on to the next question, osteoprotegerin binds to what structure to inhibit particle-induced osteolysis? And the choices are 1. RANK, 2. RANK ligand, 3. OPG receptor, 4. CD7, and 5. CD10. So osteoprotegerin binds to RANK ligand to inhibit it from binding to RANK, which are present on osteoclast precursor cells. Normally, RANK ligand interacts with RANK to stimulate activation of osteoclasts. So the correct answer to this question is 2. Osteoprotegerin binds to RANK ligand to inhibit particle-induced osteolysis. Moving on to the next question, which of the following variables is associated with elevated serum metal ion levels following metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty? And the choices are 1. Smaller implant diameter, 2. Smaller acetabular cup abduction angle, 3. Higher postoperative functional scores, 4. Severe preoperative osteoarthritis, and 5. Antiversion of acetabular cup between 10 and 20 degrees. So smaller femoral head diameter is associated with elevated serum metal ion levels with metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty. Metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty has the advantage of better wear properties, that is lower liner wear rates and volume of particles, than metal-on-polyethylene. However, elevated serum metal ion levels is one of the negatives which has received much attention recently. Studies have found smaller implant diameter and acetabular cup abduction angles of greater than 55 degrees are associated with elevated serum metal ion levels. Cup abduction angles of greater than 55 degrees lead to a more vertical cup and edge loading. Desi et al. Found that smaller implant diameter, larger cup inclination, and lower postoperative functional scores are associated with increased cobalt and chromium levels after metal-on-metal hip resurfacing. They found that severity of preoperative osteoarthritis, acetabular version, femoral stem shaft and valgus angle, and anterior orientation of the femoral component had no effect on the circulating metal ion levels. Dehan et al. Obtained serum ion levels in 214 metal-on-metal resurfacing patients at least 1 year following surgery. They found that cup abduction angles greater than 55 degrees combined with smaller component sizes led to edge loading and elevated ion levels. The correct answer to this question is 1. Smaller implant diameter is associated with elevated serum metal ion levels following metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty. Moving on to the next question. A patient undergoes a primary total hip arthroplasty with a highly cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene acetabular liner. In comparison to a 28 millimeter femoral head, a 32 millimeter femoral head will provide which of the following? And the choices are 1, increased risk of dislocation, 2, decreased range of motion, 3, decreased risk of osteolysis, 4, equivalent wear rate of the polyethylene acetabular liner, and 5, increased risk of periprosthetic fracture. So wear rates of highly cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene liners are independent of femoral head size between 22 and 46 millimeters in diameter. While the wear rates of old polyethylene liners increase with increasing femoral head size, wear rates of the new highly cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene liners have been shown to be independent of head size. This is extremely advantageous as increasing the femoral head size improves range of motion and increases jump distance, thereby decreasing dislocation rates. Geller et al. Report a prospective series of 42 patients that had a total hip arthroplasty with a highly cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene liner and a femoral head greater than 32 millimeters in diameter. After 3 years, there were no cases of osteolysis or failure due to aseptic loosening. But the correct answer to this question is 4, in comparison to a 28mm femoral head, a 32mm femoral head will provide equivalent wear rate of the polyethylene acetabular liner. Moving on to the next question. A new biomaterial has been designed for hard on soft bearings in total hip arthroplasty. The implant company claims this new material has a lower wear rate and greater toughness than highly cross-linked polyethylene. Which of the following studies would most accurately evaluate wear between the two materials? And the choices are 1, retrospective review of each material with immediate postoperative radiographs compared to annual follow-up radiographs, 2, prospective trial comparing each material with radiostereometric analysis, 3, prospective trial comparing each material with annual CT scans, 4, prospective trial comparing each material with computer-assisted edge detection radiographs, and 5, retrospective trial comparing each material with computer-assisted edge detection radiographs. So radiostereometric analysis is the most effective method to evaluate polyethylene wear in arthroplasty, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Radio-opaque tantalum beads are inserted into the bone in strategic positions surrounding the implants. An immediate postoperative film records the position of the beads. The construct can then be followed with repeated radiographs over time by evaluating the position of the components relative to the beads. Bragdon et al. Used radiostereometric analysis to compare wear rates of highly cross-linked polyethylene with 28mm and 36mm femoral heads. No differences were discovered in femoral head penetration between the two groups. McAlden et al. Summarizes the different methods available to evaluate polyethylene wear following total hip arthroplasty. Notably, radiostereometric analysis is the most accurate and precise, but is also expensive, requires technical expertise, and can only be used in a prospective manner. Moving on to the next question, which of the following is indicative of type 1 collagen breakdown and can be utilized as a marker of bone turnover? And the choices are 1, increased urinary N-telopeptide, 2, increased urinary cyclic AMP and phosphate, 3, increased urinary phosphoethanolamine, 4, increased urinary Benz-Jones proteins, and 5, increased serum bone sialoprotein. So urinary N-telopeptide is a marker of increased bone turnover and is a breakdown product of type 1 collagen. Increased serum alkaline phosphatase level and increased urinary markers of N-telopeptide, hydroxyproline, deoxypyridinoline indicate high bone turnover and can be seen in metabolic bone diseases such as Paget's disease. Von Shevelov et al. Reviewed 160 patients that underwent total hip replacements and examined their urine specimens to see if N-telopeptide levels correlated to periprosthetic osteolysis. They found that N-telopeptide levels were 1/3 higher in the patients that had evidence of osteolysis. N-telopeptide release and annual wear were both associated with increased prevalence of osteolysis in the study. So again, the correct answer to this question is 1. Increased urinary N-telopeptide is indicative of type 1 collagen breakdown and can be utilized as a marker of bone turnover. Moving on to the next question, when comparing conventional polyethylene liners to the newer highly cross-linked polyethylene liners, all of the following are true except for 1. Which of these statements about conventional polyethylene liners is incorrect? And the choices are 1, higher steady-state femoral head penetration rate, 2, more susceptible to adhesive wear, 3, generate smaller wear particle size, 4, increase fracture toughness, and 5, increase tensile strength. So all of these statements regarding conventional polyethylene liners are true except they generate larger, not smaller, wear particles than the highly cross-linked liners. It is the highly cross-linked liners that have been found to generate smaller wear particles. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Conventional polyethylene liners generate smaller wear particle size is an incorrect statement. So to quickly review again, highly cross-linked polyethylene in hip arthroplasty has been shown in multiple studies to be more wear-resistant compared to conventional polyethylene, particularly in regards to adhesive wear. The highly cross-linked poly generates wear particles of a smaller size. In a randomized clinical study with 6.8 years follow-up, McKeldin et al. Found that THA with highly cross-linked poly had a significantly lower femoral head penetration rate, that is 0.003 millimeters per year versus 0.051 millimeters per year with a p-value of 0.025, which indicates less linear wear in the highly cross-linked poly. The disadvantage of highly cross-linked poly is that the cross-linking reduces its mechanical properties, for example, decreased toughness, ductility, tensile strength, and fatigue strength. The study by Bradford et al. Looked at explanted liners and saw consistent evidence of early surface deformation and cracking. All explants exhibited some form of surface change, including surface cracking, abrasion, pitting, or scratching. The paper by Jacobs makes the point that cross-linked polys do seem to exhibit lower wear rates without significant osteolysis problems. Moving on to the next question. A 45-year-old male with a history of avascular necrosis undergoes a total hip arthroplasty using a metal-on-metal bearing. Which of the following statements regarding the use of metal-on-metal bearings is true? And the choices are 1. They produce lower serum metal ion concentrations than metal-on-cross-linked polyethylene bearings. 2. They have a decreased volumetric wear rate compared to metal-on-ceramic bearings. 3. They have smaller wear particles compared to metal-on-cross-linked polyethylene bearings. 4. They have a higher incidence of early soft tissue sarcoma compared to all other bearing surfaces. And 5. The wear rate significantly increases after the first year of use. So metal-on-metal bearings used in total hip arthroplasty form smaller wear particles compared to metal-on-cross-linked polyethylene bearings, making 3 the correct answer to this question. Metal-on-metal bearings produced higher serum metal ion concentrations, however lower volumetric wear rates and achieve a steady state of wear after the first year of use, whereby the wear rate then decreases. The volumetric wear rate of metal-on-metal articulations is greater than metal-on-ceramic as reported by in vitro studies. Also, there is no evidence to suggest an increased risk of soft tissue sarcoma with the use of metal-on-metal bearings. Moving on to the next question. All of the following are risk factors for wear-related failure in total knee arthroplasty when using a polyethylene liner that underwent sterilization via gamma irradiation in air except. And the choices are 1. Increasing shelf life of polyethylene liner. 2. Younger age of the patient. 3. Male gender. 4. Posterior cruciate retaining knee design. And 5. Use of a rough tibial base plate. So increasing shelf life, younger age, male gender, and a rough tibial base plate are all risk factors for wear-related failure in total knee arthroplasty when using a polyethylene liner. Posterior cruciate retaining knee design is not a documented risk factor. Ferring et al. Reviewed 2,091 total knee arthroplasties using the PressFit condylar system and noted that the 13-year survivorship for all patients was 82.6% with an 8.3% prevalence of wear-related failure. Cox hazards analysis revealed 5 variables that were correlated with wear-related failure, and these were patient age, patient gender, polyethylene sheet vendor, polyethylene finishing method, and polyethylene shelf age. They were unable to identify one factor as the defining reason for these wear-related failures. They cautioned that these findings may only be specific to inserts that underwent sterilization via gamma irradiation in air. But the correct answer to this question is 4. Posterior cruciate retaining knee design is not a risk factor for wear-related failure in total knee arthroplasty when using a polyethylene liner that underwent sterilization via gamma irradiation in air. Collier et al. Followed 365 total knee arthroplasties that were posterior cruciate retaining for 5 to 10 years and noted that factors related to polyethylene insert osteolysis included advanced shelf age, sterilization method, and the material from which it was machined. Osteolysis was identified in 34% with an insert that had been gamma irradiated in air and affixed to a rough base plate surface, but only 9% when the insert had been gamma irradiated in an inert gas or not irradiated at all and joined to a polished surface. Moving on to the next question. Ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene particles have been associated with osteoclastogenesis, a key component of osteolysis and total joint replacement. Which of the following accurately describes the expression of vascular endothelial growth factor and rank L during ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene-induced osteolysis? And the choices are 1, rank L expression is increased and VEGF is unchanged or mildly decreased. 2, VEGF expression is increased and rank L is decreased. 3, VEGF expression is increased and rank L expression is unchanged. 4, expression of both VEGF and rank L is increased. And 5, expression of both VEGF and rank L is decreased. So rank L, rank, and VEGF are upregulated in any process that involves increased osteoclast activity. Ren et al. Found in a mouse model study that ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene stimulation significantly increased VEGF, rank L, and rank L gene expression. VEGF inhibitor was shown to reduce the ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene-stimulated VEGF production. VEGF inhibitor also resulted in reduced rank and rank L gene transcripts. Thus, this study suggests that VEGF has a role in the regulation of rank L-mediated osteoclastogenesis. VEGF is also an important factor in angiogenesis in multiple tissues, including normal tissue, like tendons, and several cancers. But the correct answer to this question is 4, expression of both VEGF and rank L is increased during ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene-induced osteolysis. Moving on to the next question, which of the following interventions reduces osteolysis around the distal portion of the femoral stem when performing a total hip arthroplasty? And the choices are 1, use of an extended offset femoral neck component, 2, use of a proximal circumferentially coated ingrowth stem, 3, use of a collared stem, 4, use of a long femoral stem, and 5, ensuring that the stem fills the diaphysis of the femur. So osteolysis of the femur is caused by activation of macrophages by microscopic polyethylene particles within the effective joint space, which is defined as any area where joint fluid can come into contact with bone. This can occur above the acetabular cup, through screw holes, and down the femoral shaft around the prosthetic stem. Ideally, with a cementless stem, both the proximal and metaphyseal femur are well filled by the prosthesis. Collared stems are used to augment poor calcar bone quality or bone loss. Sinha et al. Showed in a retrospective review of 101 hips with cementless circumferentially coated femoral stems, no distal femur osteolysis occurred, but 82% showed evidence of proximal femur stress shielding, though only 38% showed proximal femoral osteolysis. Moving on to the next question. A 62-year-old man developed a pelvic mass 5 years after undergoing a metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty. A biopsy was performed and the histologic diagnosis of pseudotumor was made. What mechanism is associated with metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty-related pseudotumors? And the choices are 1, femoral head scratching from third body debris, 2, edge loading and associated loss of fluid film lubrication, 3, increased macrophage reactivity to P. acnes, and 4, increased lymphocyte reactivity to nickel ion. So several reports have documented the development of pseudotumors in patients undergoing a metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty. The incidence of pseudotumor is likely lower than 1% in this group of patients. Patients usually are asymptomatic. Recent investigations suggest that pseudotumors occur more often with increased wear attributable to edge loading. Edge loading most commonly results from abnormal contact stresses that occur in the setting of a malpositioned cup orientation. Lymphocyte reactivity to cobalt, chromium, and nickel did not significantly differ in patients with pseudotumors compared to patients without pseudotumors. Macrophage reactivity to P. acnes would be present in the setting of infection, but not present in the development of pseudotumors. So the correct answer to this question is 2, edge loading and associated loss of fluid film lubrication is the mechanism associated with metal-on-metal hip resurfacing arthroplasty-related pseudotumors. Moving on to the next question. In total knee arthroplasty, in vitro testing has shown that cross-linking can diminish the rate of polyethylene wear by 30% to 80%. What other change in material properties is possible when polyethylene is highly cross-linked? And the choices are 1, increased ductility, 2, increased wettability, 3, diminished fatigue strength, and 4, decreased resistance to abrasive wear. So the most important concern regarding highly cross-linked polyethylene relates to decreased mechanical properties. Cross-linking results in reduced ductility, tensile strength, and fatigue crack propagation resistance. These problems have not been identified as causing implant failure in most recent clinical trials, but remain the most important mechanical issues associated with current material processing methods. And the final question for this topic, osteolysis after total hip arthroplasty with polyethylene acetabular bearings is most closely correlated with which of the following risk factors? And the choices are 1, patient weight, 2, femoral head bearing material, 3, linear wear rate, 4, decreased femoral offset, and 5, increased femoral offset. So the development of osteolysis appears to be multifactorial. Patient activity, component positioning, polyethylene oxidation level, and bearing surface all appear to contribute. They contribute, however, by increasing the rate of wear. Therefore, the one variable that correlates closest with the likelihood of osteolysis and the magnitude of osteolysis is the wear rate of the bearing couple. Wear can be measured linearly or volumetrically. Both correlate with the development of osteolysis. But the correct answer to this question is 3. Osteolysis after total hip arthroplasty with polyethylene acetabular bearings is most closely correlated with linear wear rate. And moving on to the next topic of catastrophic wear and polyethylene sterilization, the first question reads, when comparing unaged radiated cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes treated with remelting or annealing, annealed ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes has, and the choices are 1, fewer free radicals, better mechanical characteristics, and lower wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes, 2, fewer free radicals, worse mechanical characteristics, and lower wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes, 3, more free radicals, better mechanical characteristics, and equivalent wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes, 4, more free radicals, worse mechanical characteristics, and equivalent wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes, and 5, equivalent free radicals, better mechanical characteristics, and lower wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes. So cross-linking polyethylene with radiation improves the wear properties. Persistent free radical formation within the crystalline areas of polyethylene can become oxidized in vivo. Remelting, that is heating above the melting point, or annealing, which is heating below the melting point, are processing techniques that decrease the retained free radicals. The advantage of remelting is more complete removal of persistent free radicals compared with annealing. The advantage of annealing is improved mechanical properties by avoiding disruption of the crystalline areas that occurs with remelting. Other free radical squelching methods, for example, addition of the free radical scavengers such as vitamin E, are being used to achieve both goals, that is, free radical removal and maintenance of improved mechanical properties. To date, no significant difference has been demonstrated in wear rates between the two materials. But the correct answer to this question is 3. When comparing unaged radiated cross-linked ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes treated with remelting or annealing, annealed ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes have more free radicals, better mechanical characteristics, and equivalent wear than remelted ultra-high molecular weight polyethylenes. Moving on to the next question, which of the following methods in the manufacturing process of polyethylene provides the most improvement in wear performance? And the choices are 1, Rambar extrusion, 2, sterilization in gas plasma, 3, gamma irradiation in argon, 4, irradiation in an oxygen-rich environment, and 5, sterilization in ethylene oxide. So gamma irradiation of polyethylene in an inert gas improves the wear performance of polyethylene to a greater degree than the other options listed. So the correct answer to this question is 3, gamma irradiation in argon. The most common method for sterilization of polyethylene has been direct exposure to gamma irradiation. The degree of post-irradiation degradation can be altered by changing the method of sterilization. When polyethylene is sterilized without radiation, free radicals are not formed, meaning there will be no oxidative degradation. However, this radiation-free process does not provide any cross-linking, which has been shown to decrease wear. By irradiating the polyethylene in an inert gas, cross-linking may occur while minimizing the amount of free radicals. This has been shown to greatly improve its wear characteristics. Moving on to the next question. A 75-year-old patient returns for follow-up after undergoing bilateral total hip arthroplasty. The right hip is a hybrid THA performed 12 years ago, whereas the left hip is a cementless THA performed 10 years ago. Both acetabular components are the same type, same size, and from the same manufacturer. Both femoral heads are 28mm cobalt chromium components. What is the most likely explanation for the advanced polyethylene wear in one hip? And the choices are 1, presence of a third-party abrasive particle, 2, disproportionate use of the limbs by the patient, 3, defective femoral head, 4, method of fixation of the femoral component, and 5, method of sterilization and shelf life of the polyethylene. So over the past 3 decades, gamma irradiation and air has been the most common method of sterilizing polyethylene used in total joint arthroplasty. cross-linking of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene has been shown to increase its resistance to wear, both in laboratory studies and in up to 10 years of clinical use. As the cross-linking dose is increased above the traditional range for gamma radiation sterilization, for example 2.5 to 4 MRADs, wear resistance progressively increases. What is the principal negative effect of increasing high cross-linking? And the choices are 1. The polyethylene becomes yellowish in color. 2. The polyethylene becomes dimensionally unstable. 3. The polyethylene oxidizes. 4. The polyethylene loses fatigue strength. And 5. The polyethylene absorbs joint fluid. So all of the factors equal, the fatigue strength of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene decreases somewhat as the level of cross-linking increases. Some types of cross-linking may impart a slight yellowish or gray color, but this has no clinical consequence. Cross-linking also has no substantial effect on dimensional stability. Although radiation cross-linking induces free radicals in the polyethylene that could lead to oxidation, these can be neutralized using suitable post-cross-linking thermal treatments or by the addition of antioxidants such as vitamin E. So the correct answer to this question is 4. The principal negative effect of increasing high cross-linking is that the polyethylene loses fatigue strength. Moving on to the next question. A polyethylene acetabular cup that was packaged in air and sterilized using gamma radiation has been stored unopened for 5 years. Why should this component not be implanted? And the choices are 1. It is not cross-linked. 2. It may not be sterile. 3. The design may be obsolete. 4. It may have undergone creep distortion. And 5. It may be substantially oxidized. So sterilization using gamma radiation induces free radicals that are uncombined electrons in the polyethylene. During storage in air, oxygen will diffuse into the material and react with the free radicals, causing breakage of the molecular chains. This oxidation can markedly weaken the material, making it much more susceptible to wear and fatigue fracture. The gamma radiation dose used for sterilization in the range of 2.5 to 4 MRADs induces a moderate amount of cross-linking, which, in the absence of oxidation, improves the wear resistance compared to non-cross-linked polyethylene. If the packaging has not been damaged, the component should still be sterile, even after 5 years of storage. Creep distortion should not be a problem because the component has not been under load and the design may still be appropriate for clinical use. But the correct answer to this question is 5. This component should not be implanted because it may be substantially oxidized. Moving on to the next question. When polyethylene is exposed to radiation and subsequently heated, certain chemical changes occur in the material. Which of the following statements best describes these changes? And the choices are 1. The process converts an otherwise interpenetrating network structure of polymer chains into a linear, high molecular weight polyethylene macromolecule. 2. The process increases the ductility of the material. 3. The process leads to fewer particles that are larger in size than the untreated material. 4. The process improves or lowers the wear rate but may increase the risk of fracture. And 5. The process decreases the wear rate of the material compared to the untreated polyethylene when tested against a rough counterface. So exposure of polyethylene to radiation and then heating it to quench the free radicals leads to a cross-linked material. It converts a high molecular weight polyethylene macromolecule to an interpenetrating network structure of polymer chains. The ductility of the material is decreased, hence the greater risk of fracture. While the wear rate, measured as fewer and smaller particles against a smooth counterface, is markedly reduced, cross-linked polyethylene has shown a larger increase in wear rate when a rougher counterface is used compared to a non-cross-linked material. Due to reduced mechanical strength, highly cross-linked polyethylene is less resistant to abrasive wear. Moving on to the next question. Sterilization of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene by gamma irradiation in air will degrade its wear performance because of, and the choices are 1. Oxidation, 2. Melting, 3. Cross-linking, 4. Corrosion, and 5. Creep. So again, gamma irradiation has long been used as a sterilization method for polyethylene. Exposure to gamma irradiation causes breakage of the chemical bonds in the polyethylene, and oxidation will occur if the material is subsequently exposed to the air. The amount of oxidation and decrease in wear performance is also related to the length of time that the gamma irradiated polyethylene is exposed to oxygen. But the correct answer to this question is 1. Sterilization of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene by gamma irradiation in air will degrade its wear performance because of oxidation. Moving on to the next question. What mechanical properties are observed in polyethylene used for total knee arthroplasty after the material undergoes oxidation? And the choices are 1, increased elastic modulus and decreased strength. 2, increased elastic modulus and increased ductility. 3, decreased elastic modulus and decreased strength. 4, decreased strength and increased ductility. And 5, decreased elastic modulus and decreased ductility. So when polyethylene undergoes oxidation, the material undergoes a decrease in strength and ductility and an increase in the elastic modulus. This makes the material more brittle and leaves it vulnerable to delamination, fracture, and pitting. Moving on to the next question, which of the following manufacturing techniques of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene results in the lowest susceptibility to fatigue crack formation and propagation in joint arthroplasty bearings? And the choices are 1, rambar extrusion with secondary machining into the desired product, 2, hot isostatic pressing into bars with secondary machining, 3, irradiation with 10 mRads of radiation achieving a polyethylene crystallinity of greater than 99%, 4, direct compression molding from polyethylene powder to the desired product, and 5, addition of calcium stearate to the polyethylene resin followed by compression molding into bars with secondary machining into the desired product. So the comprehensive orthopedic review states that compression molding and RAM extrusion of polyethylene exhibit equivalent wear rates, but compression molding has a lower susceptibility to fatigue crack formation and propagation. Of note, Miller's review states direct compression molding consistently produces better wear rates. So the correct answer to this question is 4, direct compression molding from polyethylene powder to the desired product has the lowest susceptibility to fatigue crack formation and propagation. So to quickly review, with direct compression, the resin is directly molded into the finished product. During rambar extrusion, polyethylene resin is extruded through a die along with heat and pressure to create a cylindrical bar that is subsequently machined into the final product. Calcium stearate was once used to prevent corrosion on polyethylene machine parts, but resulted in unfused polyethylene particles, or fusion defects, which subsequently lowered the mechanical properties of the polyethylene. High-dose irradiation, that is between 5 to 15 mRads, prompts the amorphous regions of the polyethylene to crosslink. The ideal level of crystallinity is around 50%, but a crystallinity over 70% is associated with increased polyethylene failure rates. Moving on to the next question. In evaluating methods of polyethylene sterilization for hip arthroplasty, gamma irradiation in air compared to irradiation in an inert substance results in which of the following? And the choices are 1, no difference in regards to outcome, 2, higher rate of crosslinking when irradiated in air, 3, lower rate of oxidation when irradiated in air, 4, accelerated wear and failure when irradiated in air, and 5, better resistance and longevity when irradiated in air. So the standard of care is irradiation of polyethylene in an inert gas, such as argon, nitrogen, or vacuum packaging. Irradiation of polyethylene in air, with oxygen present, results in oxidized polyethylene, while irradiation in the absence of oxygen results in greater crosslinking. The quoted study by McKellop et al. Demonstrate that irradiation in air results in early polyethylene delamination and cracking, as well as accelerated failure due to increased oxidation. So the correct answer to this question is 4, accelerated wear and failure when irradiated in air. Moving on to the next question, how are free radicals removed from highly cross-linked polyethylene? And the choices are 1, low-dose irradiation, 2, high-dose irradiation, 3, oxidation, and 4, thermal processing. So cross-linking of polyethylene improves its wear property via a series of steps including irradiation, thermal processing, and sterilization. Irradiation breaks carbon-hydrogen bonds in polyethylene and creates covalent bonds during cross-linking. Both low and high-dose irradiation create free radicals that can interact with oxygen to weaken the polyethylene. Oxidation is the process through which oxygen is introduced into the polyethylene and possibly generates free radicals. Thermal processing of irradiated polyethylene removes these free radicals. Thermal processing is the heat treatment of cross-linked polyethylene to remove free radicals. Annealing and remelting are two thermal processing types, with annealing being the preferred technique because it results in better mechanical properties of polyethylene. Another strategy that can remove free radicals is to add an antioxidant such as vitamin E. Sterilization is the final step before the packaging of polyethylene implants. But the correct answer to this question is 4, free radicals are removed from highly cross-linked polyethylene via thermal processing. Moving on to the next question, what is the difference between annealed, that is below the melting temperature, and remelted, highly cross-linked polyethylene? and the choices are 1, annealing results in lower potential for oxidation in vivo, 2, annealing results in less change to mechanical properties and strength compared to remelting, 3, remelting of polyethylene eliminates the potential for oxidation, and 4, remelting of the polyethylene removes the remaining free radicals and makes the polyethylene stronger. So polyethylene is remelted to remove free radicals that form during the radiation process for crosslinking. The disadvantage of remelting polyethylene is that it reduces the mechanical properties of the material. Annealing of the polyethylene maintains its mechanical properties but is less effective at removing free radicals, leaving the polyethylene more susceptible to oxidation. However, both annealed and remelted polyethylene have shown in vivo oxidation. So the correct answer to this question is 2, annealing results in less change to mechanical properties and strength compared to remelting. And the final question for this topic, changes to the properties of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene with increasing irradiation dose include improved, and the choices are 1, resistance to oxidation, 2, ultimate tensile strength, 3, resistance to crack propagation, 4, fracture toughness, and 5, volumetric wear. So again, increased irradiation does cause a decrease in the mechanical properties of the polyethylene, resulting in a decrease in ultimate tensile strength, fracture toughness, and resistance to crack propagation. Irradiation leads to the production of free radicals, requiring a step in the manufacturing process, like melting, annealing, vitamin E doping, to stabilize the free radicals and reduce the potential for oxidation. Wear resistance is improved with irradiation, however, there is minimal benefit with doses of greater than 10 mRads. But the correct answer to this question is 5. Changes to the properties of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene with increasing irradiation dose includes improved volumetric wear. So that's all for this question review session about wear, osteolysis basic science, as well as catastrophic wear and polyethylene sterilization. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.